Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Dear Sugar is supported by
The universe has good news for the lost, lonely, and heartsick. Sugar is here, the both of us, speaking straight into your ears. I'm Cheryl Strayed.
I'm Steve Almond. This is Dear Sugar Radio.
Oh, dear soul, won't you please share some bittersweet days with me. I check my bell vibes every day in the sugar you send my way.
Dear Sugar, how do I parent teenage children through the scary minefield of risky behaviors of sex, drugs, and alcohol, when I myself was a terrible teenager and young adult who did many things that were dangerous, illegal, and destructive? One of my sons knows of my previous behavior, only because he found my high school yearbook, which is full of notes from friends which tell many things about my past I wish he never knew. I'm ashamed and embarrassed of the things I did. He clearly knows I abused alcohol, drugs, skipped school, etc., when I was his age. How do I talk to him about my past? How do I respond to him saying, "You did all that, Mom, and you turned out fine"? I'm still making peace with my past. Thank you so much, Sugar. Signed, Former Hellraiser.
Former Hellraiser, I'm so glad that you have written us, because this is something we've thought about a lot as people who've written about our lives. And, you know, it's not in our yearbooks. It's in our books.
That's right.
And, you know, this is this real tricky, intractable problem. Do as I say, not as I do, right? For parents, at some point, our kids will know about and then know more deeply about the foibles and screw-ups of our childhood and our young adulthood and our mid-adulthood. Mm-hmm. And it gets even more complicated and fraught when it's teenagers who are entering that period where they want to push back against whatever authority is there to be pushed back against, especially parental.
Mm-hmm. You know, former Hellraiser, I really read your letter with interest, because I am constantly being asked this question as the author of a book called Wild. You know, I write about drug use. I write about promiscuity in Tiny Beautiful Things, in my Dear Sugar columns that are published in Tiny Beautiful Things. I talk very openly about all of my life. And some of that is, you know, complicated stuff that I certainly don't talk to my kids about right now. My kids are 9 and 10, so it's a little early to talk to them about some of that stuff. But really, I feel very differently about this than I sense you do in your letter. I don't think that it's destructive for our kids to know us. And by know us, I mean to know who we really are, what our lives contained, what are some of the things we did. I think that question that your son asked you when he said, "You did all of that, Mom, and you turned out fine," I think that's a great opening to a powerful and important conversation that the two of you can have. Because of the fact of the matter is, you did do all that stuff. And you learned from those things, and some of those things you probably wish you didn't do, but they were great lessons for you. Some of those things, perhaps because of your experience, you can really openly help your children navigate some of those questions. I mean, why did you use drugs and alcohol, and what was the outcome?
Right.
What did you learn from those experiences? I think sometimes we forget, especially when our kids are teenagers and they're really, their attitude is one of rejection. I think sometimes that we think they're not listening to us, but they are.
They're
I think that
listening.
Statement, you know, you did all that and you turned out fine. I really think that what your child is asking you to tell him is how, why, who are you? What did you learn? What did you know?
Right.
Even if he can't make eye contact while you're telling him those stories, he's listening. When I was about 14 or 15, really coming into my own sexuality, I remember distinctly saying to my mom, when did you lose your virginity? How old were you? And she hesitated and blushed and stammered, and I could tell she wasn't sure if she should tell me the truth. And then she decided to. And she told me the story. She told me why she became sexually active when she did. She was 17. She was in high school. It was her first love. She told me what she made of that relationship now. You know, she reflected upon whether that was a good idea or not to have sex at that age with that man,
mm-hmm.
with that young boy. And I never forgot it. It informed me. It helped me. I didn't make necessarily the very best decisions about myself sexually as a teenager. But I will say my mother's story was a guiding light to me. And I do think, former Hellraiser, that your stories not only can be guiding lights to your teenagers, but they will be. And I think that the best way for them to be is to not have them be secrets that you've buried in your life.
Right.
But rather have them be things that you say, here's what a whole person looks like. I mean, isn't that the best thing we can give our children? To show them all of our complexity, all of our humanity. They already know it anyway. They
yeah,
know.
Right.
Like our kids know, you know, they know us at our best and they know us at our worst. They know us when we're telling the truth. And they know us when we're lying.
Mm-hmm.
They know when we're fooling ourselves and when we're fooling them. And so it doesn't, you know, I would imagine that in some, maybe even, you know, sort of subconscious way, the reason that your son went and dug up that yearbook and read all that stuff is he knew what he was going to find there. He knew that you had been keeping secrets from him about your life.
Oh, and he wanted those secrets.
I mean, yeah.
One of the great mysteries, the great vault of our childhood, we're trying to, you know, find the combination that will open all that big vault of secrets that is, who were our parents before they were these people who just told us what to do and were mom and dad? Who were they when they were our age and struggling
right.
with the terrors and uncertainties and doubts and desires and confusions of this time? And you know, what's crucial is to keep that line of communication open
mm-hmm.
at all times. And part of it is telling stories if asked, and a lot of it is just listening and not making judgments.
Right.
And that I think is the thing that is the hardest, because your natural inclination is to start holding forth and saying, well, I did this and the moral is you shouldn't
you
do
don't
that.
Do it.
Teenagers, they're going to do some stuff.
Yeah.
And the problem isn't that they do a bad thing or make a bad decision, but that they learn that what they do with that is hide it away.
Mm-hmm.
And if we hide it away, we're actually directly teaching them.
So one of the things that we have the luxury, we've written books about our past, okay? We considered these documents. We wrote them some years after the experience. Our former Hellraiser has that yearbook, okay? So her son read
yeah.
the stuff that teenagers wrote, you know? So part of what she can do to sort of right that boat, I mean, I certainly don't know that I'd want my kids to read my yearbook either. But, you know, she can now narrate those years through the perspective she's gained.
Right.
So we're going to call somebody who has done that same kind of work,
yes.
the amazing, beautiful, brilliant writer Mary Carr.
So excited.
Who is the author of three memoirs, The Liars Club,
mm-hmm.
Cherry, and Lit. I love them all.
Yes.
Lit is, I think, my favorite among them, but it's hard to choose. And all of them write about these issues of, you know, the mistakes we made, essentially, the wild days of her youth, her 20s and 30s, and she herself has raised a son. So she made it all the way through that fire, not only her own fire, but the you know, she's raised a son as well. Hey, Mary, how are you?
Hello, gorgeous. This is a warm up for our talk show, which is going to be called Girls Gone Miles.
Ah. You're going to be our sex and drugs and rock and roll correspondent.
Oh, I can't wait. Since I've been sober 25 years out, I mean, you know, I got sober before like crack cocaine and wine coolers. I mean, it's amazing what I missed.
Well, what's so funny about that? And let's talk about that for a second, because, you know, here you and I are like this sort of poster kids for like slutty, druggy, drinky.
Right, exactly.
And I'm like, yeah. we're like
the bad moms or the after school special.
Exactly. Yeah. And yet, meanwhile, we've been actually these incredibly hardworking, upright, fine young citizens.
Humble.
And humble, too.
Right. Yeah, right. Don't Plus adorable.
Right.
Plus adorable. But do you know what I'm saying? It does become this funny thing where you write a book about your wilder days, and you've written more than one. I do.
See, everybody assumes that I'm still a slutty drug user.
I know.
I mean, no, I think they look at you and they know that you're now Reese Witherspoon. But they look at me and they think I'm still just a derelict slattern.
What about slattern? I love it. I love that you use the word slattern.
She's a poet. She's not used enough. She's not like a lowly prose writer. She's a poet. She knows how to use a word.
Yeah, but poets have to take the subway.
That's right. So began my life as a slut. She would say, so began my life as a slattern.
That's right.
Right, exactly.
Let's back up here. So, as you know, we have this letter from this former Hellraiser who's mortified that her teenage son has, you know, learned about her past that involves sex and drugs and skipping school and so forth. And before we called you, Steve and I discussed this a bit. We both also have, like most people, have done things in our youth that we don't want our kids necessarily to do.
Right.
But we called you because you're very famously having written about your kind of wilder young days and the struggles you went through, even as a young mother. You know, you didn't become sober until your son was how old?
Three and a half.
So we would love to hear your story and to get some of your thoughts on how your past has come to bear on your life as a mother and how you parented your son through those years when he was asking some of those questions.
I put a stake in the yard and a damned ankle bracelet on him and a tracking device.
And he circled
that pole until he got to college.
That's right. Well, you were raised in Texas. That's how they do it down there, right?
That's what I wish I could have been, right?
Correct.
So, Mary, tell us a little bit about the concise story of your past and your trajectory as a mother.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I discovered the wonderful world of drugs and alcohol when I was about 15, and I was like a relief-seeking missile, you know. I wanted relief, and when I was 17, I left home, and I lived in a car in Laguna Beach, California, and then moved into a house with a bunch of drug dealers. So, that's what my life was like, and Deb knows Uncle Dooney, who used to sell drugs. And
Deb is your son.
Young Deb is my son. Yes. Now he's 28.
Wow.
So yeah, him's all grown up. long before he was a teenager, I took him to the graveyard. I said, remember Gary? I talked about my peers where Gary buried, and Dooney and I walked across around the graveyard and talked about all the people we drank and did drugs with.
Really? Were you doing that to protect him from, to educate him on the risks of such behavior, or what were your intentions?
Well, I mean, I wasn't going to lie to him
about
what I had done. And in my family, you know, my father drank himself off a bar stool and was bedridden for 5 years with a stroke, you know, and my mother almost died and I almost died. And I checked into a mental institution when he was, I guess, 3.5 years old, when I was newly sober. And I suffered a very serious depression, and I was suicidal. And so I was scared. I was scared for him. And he has alcoholism on both sides of his family. So, you know.
How do you think that influenced him as a teenager during those years when he was testing all the limits we do? Do you think that he was aware of the life you'd had? Do you think that made him wilder and more of a hellraiser? Or do you think that it helped temper some of that urge within himself?
I think it helped temper it. It's funny. You know, Corin Zailkas, who wrote that memoir, Smashed, was a student of mine, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
She babysat Dev. And she tells a story about picking him up from school after lacrosse practice or something when he was maybe 14. And one of her friends looked at him, and he was 6 feet tall and looked like a J. Crew model, and said, "Do you party?" One of her little drunk sorority friends said, "Do you party to this?"
What did he say?
And he said, "Well, actually, you know, we have a lot of depression in my family, and alcohol is a depressant drug, so I don't party."
Right. It's interesting. Before we started talking to you, Steve and I talked about this letter from former Hellraiser, and we were saying, look, you know, our approach is to tell our kids about our lives, you know, that we actually think it serves them to know that their parents are complex and we've made mistakes and we've come through it. In some ways, it's those lessons that, you know, we're all going to face that urge to take risks and to do things that aren't the wisest things to do.
Well, what's your plan when your kids get older? Are you going to be? I was super restrictive.
Huh.
Super, super restrictive. I wasn't one of those, "Oh, let's buy them a keg and they can drink at home, Mom."
Yeah, I'm not that mom either. I'm restrictive too.
Those people, the people who do that, I think are often just don't have the kinds of propensity to drink a drug that you and I have.
Well, I think, or the opposite. I think they're addicts. A lot of those people, they're justifying their own behavior.
Well now, hold on a moment. If I may speak for the minority, I remember getting stoned with my dad. I would say they were kind of upwardly mobile hippies, and that was part of the counterculture. It was when I was a teenager, and again, they were not addictive people, and they were moderate users, and that was always clear to us. But it did have the effect, and everybody has a different experience, but it did have the effect, I think, of not making drugs feel contraband. And I actually was never interested in doing much more than smoking pot and never really had a taste for alcohol. But I did feel like somehow it wasn't off limits, and so it didn't have that shimmering aura of the, you know, forbidden.
Right.
I mean, the truth is, I think you're hardwired. The poet Paul Celan said, you know, about drinking, it's like a sunflower opens in your chest. You know, you either fall in love the first time you get really wasted.
Right.
Or you don't. So, you know, all due respect, Steve, I, you know, my partner now, Michael, that he was one of those, "Oh, buy him a kick." Well, let me tell you, if it had been my kid, he would have been the drunkest kid in school.
Yeah.
I think in my family, I think it's like a firearm. It's genetic roulette.
Yeah,
this is the percentage chance that you have that you will be an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Now my hope is that never happens. You know, blah 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 blah. But it's interesting that I think, I mean, I'm half Irish and half Native American, or three quarters Irish and a quarter Native American. Cultures like that haven't had alcohol for very long have a very high percentage of alcoholics because we haven't been bred out.
Yeah.
Jews, Italians, you know, my Jewish fella, him and his kids, yeah, they had kegs in the yard. But I think if you're not from an alcoholic family, it's easy to be glib about because it's not that dangerous maybe for you. You don't have that genetic component. So I don't know. I mean, I do know that I kept him off the stuff till he was about 17.
Yeah, which is an accomplishment.
But he made that decision of his own volition when faced with great temptation. Not only do you party, but some older pretty girl asking, "Do you want to party?" He had it within himself. Somehow he had absorbed the idea of, actually, no, that's not a good idea for me in particular. And you must have had something to do with that.
And he has said now, I mean, he doesn't drink now. And he has said, you know, that the fact that my mother was sober and I was sober and he met so many sober people. And he also saw them, you know, get drunk. And you know, I did a lot of work at a halfway house in Boston. And, you know, there was a guy who was a lawyer who passed out in a snowbank and lost his hands and feet, you know.
Yeah. I
mean, you know, one minute you're okay, the next minute you've lost your hands and feet. You know, I mean, he saw that there were some real consequences, I think.
Right. And so I think it's not that the key isn't just to shield them from the fact that, you know, people do things, including sometimes their very own parents have done these things, but to, in fact, do the opposite, like show them the whole picture, give them all that information. I do think, absolutely, it's amazing that Deb, you know, like Steve said, it's this cute young girl is saying, "Do you party?" So not only is the temptation the alcohol itself, but the girl and just the headiness of that situation.
Yeah.
And Mary, I think if I'll speak for us, you know, maybe you too, Steve, like if when I was 14, if that had happened to me, I just the allure of that risky, sexy,
right?
I would have leapt right into those arms, you know, and not so much for myself as a, you know, an alcoholic or a drug addict, but really just the allure of that risk taking. And I do think that because you were so open about your life that, you know, Dev also, he understood it to be a cautionary tale about his own life. And that's, you know, you asked me what I'm going to do with my kids. I try to tell my kids as much truth as I can, you know, at the right age, that, you know, in a sort of developmentally appropriate time. And, you know,
right.
they haven't seen the movie Wild, and I'm not going to let them because they're too young to see it. But they did see the trailer. And what was really fascinating to me, we watched it, you know, time and time and time again. And after about the 10th time, my son Carver turned to me and said, "Mom, what's heroin?" And that's what I did. I said, because there's a line in the trailer where a therapist says to Reese Witherspoon, who's playing me, "You are using heroin." And I had to explain to my kids what heroin was and what I was doing using it and how that played out in my life. And it was really hard, but it was also, what's so great about it is they understood, like they got it to the extent that they could. And I do think that it will in some ways guide them to know, to see that experience in humanity in this person. You know, so often when it comes to our mothers, we think of them in a very sort of narrow box. And
oh, yeah, of course, right? I'm a purveyor of waffles.
That's right. Yeah, and when we can expand that, I mean, one of my favorite passages in all of your writing is the prologue of Lit, or is it chapter one of Lit, where it's a letter to your son?
Yeah, it's the prologue of Lit is a letter to my son. That's right.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it's such an amazing passage, and I think that it speaks directly to this question. Because here you are about to launch in the book, you know, on this essentially this story of your reckless, you know, youth and your alcoholism and your recovery and all of this. But you write to Dev. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I had a sense that I wanted to establish what the stakes were. And the stakes were you hurt your children. I mean, you do. One hurts one's children. It doesn't matter who you are or how competent you are. And the first, you know, I was in a mental institution when he was 3.5 years old. He had to come see me, you know, and go through security. I mean, God. And he remembers that. He thought it was part of Harvard.
But
I published Cherry when Dev was 14. And one of the kids at his school said, he had said to me, "I don't think I'm ready to read your books." My son had said that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he came home and said, you know, so-and-so's brother said that you were like, you had a gangbang and blah, 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 blah. I was like, no. Here's what happens in the book. You know, I had a boyfriend and I slept with him. We sort of make out and sleep together, you know, in the car when I was a virgin. And, you know, and then, yeah, I moved and lived in a car with Uncle Dooney and all those guys who were selling drugs.
And what I think is, you know, just like you, you didn't hand your books to Dev and say, "No, time to get to know mommy better."
Right.
You know, I believe that our, you know, the children of writers will come to their work when they're ready to. And I think the same is true of people who aren't writers, like this letter writer, you know, the former Hellraiser. Her teenage sons might not in this moment fully understand why their mother did the things she did when she was a teenager. But as they grow and as they evolve and as they come into their own sense of self as they grow up, you know, they're going, I think that we really respect that kind of the humanity in our parents when we know them
right
for who they are. And so I love that my kids will someday get to read about who I was before they came along.
Well, I think it's also interesting what she says. You know, this kid is obviously trying to justify doing what she did. And I remember saying to Deb when he was a kid, "Look, here's what the deal is," when he was like 15 or 14. "So you're going to want to drink and have sex and do drugs. I want you not to drink and have sex and do drugs. That's not negotiable. You're going to continue to want to do those things, and I will continue to try to prevent your doing them."
Wow.
So that's just the rule. That's just what we're engaged in. Let's not make it personal. Let's not make it like that I'm a bad person or you're a bad person. Let's just make it that this is what I'm doing and this is what you're doing.
But did he come over the top and say, but Mom, you did those things and you turned out fine? Because that's what former Hellraisers...
No, actually what he said was, you don't understand, you're crazy. You think because you had a problem that I'm going to have a problem like you. And you think everybody's an alcoholic. He said all this stuff. She said, it doesn't matter. I busted you with beer with your friends, ergo, you no longer have a car. You know, that's it's just the rule. Like, I'm not, I think for me, it was not getting angry about it, but just having a line.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It was like, I'm not mad about this.
It's nothing personal.
I think that's a really great way, great advice, and a really clear way to think about it. Because the other thing is, this letter writer, she's like, it's as if she's back a teenager again. And, you know, you as the mother, you were saying, I am your mother right now. And yes, I did all these things back in the day. And this is why I know you're going to want to do these things too. And my job is to support you in making better choices, you know? And I think to be very clear about, your role in somebody else's life in that regard.
Yeah, I did that step because nobody really gave a rat's ass what I was doing.
That's right.
Right? They weren't watching. No one was paying attention.
It
was a lack of care.
So I think that's, can you be, I'm sort of short a mom. Can you be my mom, Mary Carr?
I want to be your mom, Cheryl. If I could only be like, as blonde as you and have those boobs. If I could have bequeathed that hair and those boobs to you, it would be so nice.
I know. I'm
your mom. Just have the kids call me grandma.
Yeah.
And we'll just start right now.
This works perfectly because, you know, you and I are kind of softies and we want to like talk with our kids. And
that's
Mary
right.
would just be like, it's nothing personal, Carver, Bobby. These are the rules.
That's right.
I'll stick a stake in the front yard. I'll put an ankle chain on you. And that's just the rules. This is how we do it. It's just business.
The other thing I did was nobody talks about the emotional torment of having sex when you're young.
Oh, right. Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Nobody talks about the concept. Like when Dad broke up with his first girlfriend when he was in the ninth grade, I said, now think about it. What if you had slept with her and she went and talked to all her girlfriends at school about what you look like naked?
Yeah.
How would you feel?
I still feel terrible about that. No, I was actually trying to figure out. So are you saying that before you have sex, you're supposed to get naked? That strikes me as completely
I'm just trying
out of
to
control.
Help you out. I'm
All
trying
right.
to help you broaden.
Maybe I need
I'm
some
to
parenting,
you,
too.
I'll be your mommy, too. I'll help you broaden your horizon.
Thank you for letting us talk to you and call you.
Yes.
It means so much to us.
We'll do this again soon,
we'll do it again. Clearly, you have a lot of... what I love about anyone with a life who's also written memoir is that they're totally... Like, we can ask them anything and they won't flip out. So we're going to be calling you again, Mary Carr.
Okay, I'm ready. Talk to y'all soon.
All right, bye, hon.
Take
bye.
Care. I'm just quietly traumatized by that entire conversation. I'm just having to reassess a lot of things.
I love Mary Carr.
I love Mary Carr,
don't
too.
Don't you? What are you reassessing?
Well, one of the things that she said that is profound, that we really should try to, you know, integrate into our answer to former Hellraiser, is that there is a difference depending on kind of how you and your family culture and even, you know, your genetic legacy interacts with drugs and alcohol.
Right.
And for her, it was a very different matter. She laid down a real Old Testament line. But I think the thing that comes through is she was paying attention to her son. Mm-hmm. And her son was acutely aware of that. And even when they go into their exile and adolescence, I think kids are acutely aware of whether somebody is really paying attention. And so even if you take a softer approach of saying, I'm simply going to be here, I'm going to listen without judgment, or you take that sterner line and say, it's nothing personal, kid, but these are the rules. It's just business. In our family, you have to stay away from these things. That's my job. And there are going to be clear limits about that. In both cases, the message that's clearly coming across that former Hellraiser you need to hear is, you need to be paying attention to your son. Whatever answer you come up with, and hopefully it's one that's as honest and unembarrassed as you can make it, but also accurate. Yes, I did these things, and they caused me a great deal of pain and harm, And so naturally, I don't want you to feel that pain and harm. He needs to know that you're paying attention and not keeping secrets from him about who you were.
That's right. Well said. I loved Mary's clarity. I think that clarity was born of so many complex things that she had to confront in herself, in her family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she brought all of that into her mothering with a clarity of purpose that her son wouldn't follow in their footsteps, that
right.
she would do everything she could to prevent that from happening. And I hope, former Hellraiser, you can take a bit of that wisdom with you on your parenting journey.
We've come to the end of another Dear Sugar podcast. I have important things that I need to tell you. Dear Sugar is produced by WBUR in Boston. Our producer, our editor, is the wonderful Lisa Tobin. And thanks to Jim Brunberg, our engineer. We would love to hear from any or all of you who are brave enough to write.
It's dearsugarradio@gmail.com. Thanks.